Mr. Rayner Taylor, Reel 19. You were saying that Lloyd George gave you a photograph.
Photograph.
Cut in two.
Yes, and I don't know for sure, but I understood that he gave him the other half to what we know now as a canteen manager. She was somebody who organised the feeding of troops on the way or back. There was always some food going. And I understood that he gave her the other half. I didn't pay a great deal of attention to it. And where he went to, I don't know. I'm mad about that, you know. It would have been quite something now. Especially if I could got the other half and all.
Had you been in any way prepared for this? I mean, had you been told to get smartly turned out?
No preparation at all.
So you weren't in super smart order?
Oh dear, no. It was an ordinary day's job of examining passport. No, there was no such thing as being spruced up. There was no officer present at all.
Anything else you remember about that time?
No, not a great lot. We were on passport duty for...
Would you check people coming in?
In, yes.
As well as people going out?
No, not going out, not coming in.
Who would check them coming in?
Well, what were coming in were the main military personnel, you know. We had a batch of Australians came in one time. That was a bit scary because... they were supposed to be all under sentence of death, there were a lot. About 12 of them. And,
did you know what for?
Desertion, probably murder, I don't know. But they were all under sentence of death. But they daren't have done it, you know. They daren't have carried it out. And during the crossing, they'd broken out of their... cells or whatever it was, and they managed to get hold of a rifle or two, and they were shooting at the smokestack. And you could hear them. Of course, we got word, and of course we had to go on. We were sent on duty on the dockside, and we were issued with rifle and bayonet. We were issued with them. We didn't have them normally, you know. Oh, when this boat came in. And these Aussies came off. They were first off. They kept everybody on board till they got these Aussies off. And they managed to get drink while they were on board. They were... on that occasion, I was well away from where the boat came in. I was nearer to the gate. These Aussies came off. Slouch hat, swaggering... as if they had to carry the world. And I was there, oh, I hope they don't stop here. Because they just walked off in ones and twos. And they joke with you, they joke with the guards. And when one fellow got to me, I was only very small, and we were a massive man. And he said, and I was still with my rifle, I was still the side. He said, "Hi, Copper, what are you going to do with that? My rifle. Asking me what I'm going to do with it." I said, I remember, "I don't know." He says, "No, I think not." And he just, and suddenly that, and he got hold of it. Over above, and he just shoot, and he's shaking me about. Scared. And then, as well, he was talking to me, these other fellows were. Came until I had about six of them around me. I think I was an object of sympathy for them because they went on and they were taken to a hut just outside the dockside. It was a hut that we used at one time when we were on this passport duty, and they sent guards from. There was a military camp at Shorncliffe, that's near. And they sent guards from Shorncliffe to look after these fellows. Look after them. They were there one night, they kicked them back out of the hut and walked out. And nobody tried to stop them. No. All they wanted was to get out of them. And I don't know what happened to them, but they were... They just went down. There was inquiries as to how it had happened and why they hadn't been stopped. Nobody wanted to stop them. Aussies. There'd be about 12 of them. They were a rum lot that were.
Anything else you remember from that time at Folkestone?
No, gradually the duties decreased and they came. Demobilisation were coming nearer and nearer then.
So you were demobilised from Folkestone, were you?
Yeah. Yes, not that. Probably that would be my last job. You're demobilised from your depot, the depot was at Whitchurch.
Priest Heath?
Yes. And you went back to the same place you'd started from. That's where your demobilisation.
What do you remember about your demobilisation? What happened to you?
Well, you got a suit.
What was wrong with it?
Oh, well, it was thick.
Was it a reasonable style?
Well, they looked at you and said, "That'll do," and threw it at you. Style, you know, blowing style about them.
Did you ever wear it?
Jackets were straight, and I think we got a hat. I don't know if we got a hat or a cap. But you could retain your overcoat. They didn't give you a coat. You retained your overcoat, and after you'd been demobilised, if you took your coat to a railway station, they gave you £1 for it. So that's give you time to get one at home, but you got £1 for your overcoat. Now, for a long time, a long, long time after the war, there were military gate coats in use, people who hadn't handed them in, you know, because despite what anybody said, it was jolly good stuff, you know, hard-wearing stuff.
Did you hand yours in for £1?
Oh, yes. Yes, we got £1 for that.
Well, did you get your pay settled up?
Yes.
Did you have much owing to you?
No, not a great lot. Because you never had any... there was never any way you could check up whether they were right or not. You accepted what they said. You wouldn't know... you were paid 1 week, not paid at all, you didn't know, but it was supposed to be credited to you. And
did you get any sort of a bonus? I know you got something for your finger.
No, nothing. Just your back pay, that was
and
all.
And you got your finger, the bonus for your finger later, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
I went before
a pensions board, you know, and everybody that had been...
When was that?
Just before I was immobilised.
And what happened there?
Well, they examined it and they see what... they didn't look any, had a finger off. And the fact that this finger was so important to my work, although they didn't know, they had no idea. They were army officers or doctors. I remember the man that examined me was... He wasn't good at all, because when I said my job, it was a peace researcher. Peace what? Right, nasty he was. And even I tried to explain to him, he just didn't want to know. And he said, right on. And I was awarded 12.5% disability pension, which I never drew. Because they sent me word just afterwards that this pension had been commuted into whatever, I don't know, 30, 60 pounds, 30 quid or something like that, as a final payment, and that's what I got. And that was the end of it.
Now, when you came out of the army, you went home. Do you know when you got out of the army, roughly speaking?
No, I
was
no.
It still in 1919?
Oh, yes, it was 1919.
Because there's a story about when you went back and all the three brothers were together.
Oh, yes. It would be 1919. And we were all at home. And it was the first time that we were all in uniform. And that's the photograph. Because my dad said...
Had you left the army then, or is this just before?
No, we weren't in the army. We were on demobilisation leave. And my father said, he spoke a bit by you, I want you to go and have your photos, Duke. I want them all together. And there was this photographer's over there. And we went, and that's the photograph that we had taken.
Of the three of you in uniform?
The three of us in uniform. That was the only time that we ever were. And then, of course, he bought us our celebration drink.
Can you tell us that story about the drink? Because it showed how you'd grown up a bit,
well,
didn't it?
Well, yes. Why, it was one dinner time. And we'd had our dinner at home. And my father said, we never called him father, he was always my dad. My dad said, I want you to go and have your photos, Duke, this afternoon, and then come over to the institute.
Which institute is that?
This is where I eventually became the secretary of. This is the Hollywood Institute. So we went and we did have our photographs taken. And then we went to this institute. Now, he'd gone there. He used to go and read. They had a reading room in those days. They used to have newspapers, glossy magazines, where members could go and read, you know. That's how my dad used to spend his free afternoons, going to read the Tatler Illustrated London News and Punch and two or three of the morning papers. Anyway, we went in. And I could see my dad, now he got up off this, where he was sat, reading. Hey, hello, he said, come on. And he took us to the bar. There were quite a few of the fellows, members in it. These are my lads. Oh, they probably knew it, but they'd never seen us all together. These are my lads. I got up to the bar and he said to Albert, oh, what about Albert? Big out to you because you were buying the earth. Oh, what about Albert? Hmm. Albert said, a pint. Spoiled my dad's day, that did. Oh, ruined it, we were ruined then, because our Albert had left home at 17-year-old as a boy. Went to Sunday school 3 times on Sunday, and next time he comes in contact with his father, he's ordering a pint. Oh, dear. Anyway, he relaxed because he'd been missing, believe, killed for months. And then he said to our Jack, well, there, Jack. Our Jack don't say he'd have a pint. No, well, you were the eldest. Oh, he said, I'll just have a jelly. He said, well, do you know, does there start need supping? He bought him a jelly. Didn't give me the chance. He just looked at me and said, they'll have a shandy. He didn't even ask me what I were having. And that's all I got. So the returning servicemen, 3 servicemen, we got a pint and a half of beer and a shandy. That were our reward.
You did, of course, drink then, didn't you?
We were all taking a drink off on this.
Did he soon get used to the fact you'd grown up?
He never did get used to it. Never did get used to that. Because after demobilisation, we got back to work. Our Albert in particular, he used to go up in the town with lads, because after demobilisation in 1990, it says a lot for the British character that there wasn't a mutiny or something, because there were so many soldiers coming back into civilian life who'd been tied down by strict discipline for years, so there was a tendency for them to get off the hook. They went pretty mad at times.
And did your Albert?
Our Albert, he got friendly with some, and he never came home drunk or anything like that, but they didn't like the type of people that he was associated with. But there were people he'd been in the army with. He'd done 4 years with them. And I remember one night, they must have been in Bother somewhere. He came home, well, oh, and he's the loveliest black eye you've ever seen in your life. with a beauty. Walked in. My dad looked at him. My mother began to cry. My dad looked at me and said, "Serve the righty." That was all. No, I was the only remark that was made about it. I served the righty.
Did he get a job, Albert?
Oh, right. He went back to the jobs that they'd left in the mill.
They'd been kept for them.
Oh, well, yes. Oh, yes, because there were a lot of women worked, and they were absorbed back into their mills.
The women lost their jobs, then?
Yes, because the whole world were starved of cotton goods. You see, until everything was on full belt, you know, jobs.
What about you? Because you'd lost your finger.
Well, I went back into the mill, but in a different department.
Now, what department did you...
I went into packing the finished product. Packing, that's all you could say.
Did that pay as much as your old job?
No, not quite as much. It would be in the lower scale than those on the machines, you know. But not great, not very much lower, but it was lower.
Now, you say your mother advised you to spend your bonus, your wound bonus,
yes,
or wound pension, settlement.
By that time, I think I'd got another girl then. I think I was playing with another girl. Went back to Sunday school, you know. I used to go walks with her. And my mother strongly advised that I spent this money on buying a house. Now, I can't think of anybody in our time of life, or I can't think of anybody owning their own house. They were all rented properties, you know. Buy a house. They didn't own their own house, you know. The house that they lived in were rented. But I don't know if she did, but I think she kept a tight hold on the bank book. I think so. And she did search round for a house. And if she heard of one that would be coming on the market, she couldn't look at it. About three or four she'd been and looked at, and she'd drag me and look at them, you know. And I was only half interested, because I'd have felt much better having a right good fling with money, you know, but no. And eventually this row of houses came on sale, but they were all tenanted. And they were being sold as a lot. And if you were bought in one block, would be £120 a house. But if they were split and it was bought singly, it was £190. The reason being that I suppose it would cost more for making the deeds out and things like that. And although it was tenanted, and my mother, she had me coming round, and we decided I bought this house. We got a mortgage from the store called Co-op.
So you used your money?
For the deposit. And every week, every Friday, I used to come and collect the rent off these people. Always.
The sitting tenant?
Oh, yes. In those days, because of the shortage of houses, there'd been no houses built for 4 years, you know. You couldn't evict a sitting tenant unless you found them, or they found alternate accommodation. You couldn't do it. No way could you do it. And I waited. I did eventually get married, and I was still not in my own house. And I went to live with what became my wife's sister. Quite a way up, halfway up into Oldham, into the town. And lived there about nearly 2 years. And he was to come down every Friday night to collect this rent. And the rent was 7 and 4 pence a week. 7 and 4 pence. And I, as a landlord, you're responsible for all the repairs. The tenant was expected to do their own decorating. And it was a... When I used to go home, you say, have you heard anything? That meant to say, I'd heard about these people getting out. And you always had your ear to the ground, see if you could hear of anybody who were likely to move and try and get the house for these people who were in yours. They didn't mind, because you'd have to rehouse them before you get them out. And eventually, a right series of events happened. There were 7 people moved. A house became vacant. And so somebody had bought, and they moved in. In moving in, they left their own, and somebody moved in theirs. And there was a sequence of 7 removals. And we were the last. And it was Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve. And 7 people moved on that day to get in their own house. Marvellous. And now we worked. We worked till 5:30. And I'd arranged with the chap who did the carrying at the mill. With a horse and... it was 2 horses and a lorry with a big high seat, you know. And I'd arranged for him to come to the house I was living at. Collect my furniture that we got there and bring it down here. And on the way, to collect a suite which we had stored at my brother's, who lived just behind where we've been for lunch, today. Went home from work, and first thing we did, of course, we stripped the bed, got everything out, the bed, and everything that we could get were on the pavement. The last thing, of course, was they didn't have mattresses then, they were flock beds. They were great things that were filled with flocks. And eventually this fella came, and I can see him now coming along this street. Two storm lamps hanging down because it was dark, you know. And he came to the where we were, where I was waiting with the furniture. And he turned his lorry around in the street, 2 horses, turned it round. And we began loading. Well, it didn't take us long because we hadn't a great lot of stuff. We loaded this, and I said, now we have to leave room at the back end of this lorry to fit a 7-piece suite on. Oh, it don't matter. And the last thing that they put on the lorry there was the flock bed. Now, by this time, the wife, she was here. She was going to superintend, along with my father, superintend where they were to put the furniture. And I rode down from there, here, lay on top of the flock bed, clutching a great big clock. I did. You could have made a film out of it. And when we got onto the main road... The trams were running then, and if he could get the wheels in the tram lines, they're always about the same gauge. You know, because they were cobbles, there were no bumping right there. And the horses, they ran down from there right to where my brother lived, back of where we've had lunch. And he kept in the tram lines, a right smooth ride. And trams used to pass on what they called loop lines. It was single track, and then there'd be a loop line so that trams could pass. And even when he came to a loop line, he steered the horses around and kept on this track. They were marvellous. We got to our jacks, and very quickly loaded this suite on. Came here. This street wasn't paved then, you know. Pulled up at the front, and there's me dad and wife waiting. And we had a lot of helpers. And I remember, I said, wife will call Hilda. Hilda said, stand here and tell them where to put it when they fetch it in. We decided where it was going. And we had a new carpet for you, I think it were 3x3. Oilcloth round. A new gas shade. And I think we had oilcloth in the bedroom. We had no stair carpet, of course. But I think the oilcloth in the kitchen. And we stood there, and she stood there, and as they brought things in, like when they brought the bed in, he said, right, go and see him put that bed up, Reet. So she sent her upstairs to see that the bed was set. And me, I'm running about like an old hen, you know. I was supervising my own tip-pot way. And eventually got there in very, very short time. We got this house. It was a palace to us, you know. It was mine.
And when did you bought it? And when did you move in? Do you know what year?
Just over 2 years.
And what year did you bought it in?
Bought it 1921 until end of 22. Something like that it was, you know.
And your mother must have died shortly after?
Shortly afterwards, yes.
Was it shortly after you bought it or shortly
after? Shortly after we moved in. I lived here when she died. Anyway, when this... they emptied this lorry, and the carrier and his son, they were both in the business, I said to him, said to the father, I said, now then, Jack, what shall I give you now? I mean, meaning, how much are we charging for this removal? Oh, he said, see how we're Robert. So I said to the son, who'd done a lot of the humping about, he said. I said, hey, Bob, now how much? He said, well, give us $1. That was fine, Bob. And I said, hey, what about fancy a drink? He said, why? He said, I was getting a big jug. I said, and he went to Gardner's, that pub where we were, and he brought a quart of ale in a big jug. So my removal, for the only time in my life, cost me 5 shillings and a quarter mile beer. And I've never moved since. Quite story of my life.
Now, what did your mother actually die of? Was it actually...
Cancer.
It was cancer.
She had a cancer. By that, she became very frail.
And you think it was brought on by
the stress? I couldn't think of anything else. And there wasn't as much. There wasn't as many things for alleviating pain as there is now. Morphia was the thing, and it was a sad experience for us because we'd been a close family, and. It took her 3 months to die, in awful agony. I've always had a dread of it since, you know.